Stu Does America.
Welcome to Stu Does America. Predictable with Stu Bergier is another show I'm going to be doing very soon. Coming soon to a YouTube channel near you. Very near you if you happen to be on YouTube.com/Stu Does America right now, because this is where the show is going to be in the coming weeks. Make sure to go to predictableshow.com. This is the reason why we're calling it predictable, by the way, is it is a show talking about the news of the day like we do here every day, but talking about it in the kind of context of prediction markets. This is a way to kind of crystallize the truth a little bit better than a lot of the punditry that we sometimes do. With a lot of opinion in there. This is kind of trying to look through all that and see what is really there, plus an opportunity for you to profit off of this. I keep thinking of it this way. Politicians have been making a lot of money off of us over the years. I think it's time we make some money off of them. That's the way I'm looking at it. So make sure to check out predictableshow.com. It's you'll get a newsletter, a way to understand these markets as we go forward in the future weeks, and a cool way to understand the election in much more depth than I think you're going to get anywhere else. Predictableshow.com. By the way, we're still here doing Stu Does America for you as well, and excited to do so with Blaze TV. They've been great partners through all of this, and we're really excited about it. Okay, Greg Wrightstone is going to be here to celebrate the demise of the endangerment finding, which is a very nerdy celebration, I will say, but I love it. I got a crazy story about a multi-billion dollar Bitcoin blunder to tell you about, but we're going to start by doing the bursting EV bubble. Ah, yes, the bursting EV bubble. Let me start, though, in a little bit of a different part of the world and watch CNN, because look, no one was watching this live, but we've seen the clip now. A big step in the right direction. CNN economic reporter raves over new inflation report. And you just wonder when you're watching something like this happen, given that this is Donald Trump's presidency, the economy is supposed to be in utter collapse all the time when he's in office. That is the role of MS Now, is it? I don't know. I haven't watched it at all since they changed from MSNBC. But MS Now, multiple sclerosis right now. It's a demand. We want it. MS Now. That whole, catastrophe of a network and CNN, their goal, generally speaking, is to tell you how terrible things are under Donald Trump. It's the entire business plan of the network. So I don't know how many people got fired after this segment, but somebody had to. Here is Matt Egan on CNN.
This is some encouraging news on the cost of living, right? Inflation took a big step in the right direction to start the year off. So consumer prices up by 2.4% year over year. That is an improvement from 2.7% in December that beat expectations, which were for 2.5%. In fact, this is a new 8-month low for annual inflation, month over month. Prices up by 0.2%. Also a step in the right direction, also beating expectation. Now, economists look really closely at core inflation, right, which excludes food and energy. Core inflation came in at 2.5%. That's notable because that's the lowest annual inflation rate for core since March of 2021, before the inflation crisis. Now, while we can't exclude food and energy from our family budgets, that's important because economists say that's a better indicator for where inflation is going. And when you look at the trend for inflation over the last few years, you can see there's been some improvement, right? It's been a little bit bumpy on this chart. It's been bumpy. But it has improved. There was this uptick in inflation starting last spring after the president slapped massive tariffs on imports. Inflation started to go heat back up to 3%. But thankfully, it's trending back down. Now, when we look at some of the notable categories as far as what people are seeing at the store, especially the grocery store, a couple things stand out. And not all of it's good. Bad news, uncooked ground beef. Look at this, 17% more expensive year over year. Kate, that's the biggest increase since the middle of 2020 during COVID. Wow. Also, piped gas, that's natural gas, up by 10%. Yeah. We know that's been a problem. Electricity, that continues to be another source of frustration, up by 6%. However, also some good news. Look at this, egg prices plunging by 34%. That's the biggest decline for eggs since 2016, back when Obama was in the White House. And gasoline prices, which of course was such a major problem for so long, they were down by 8%.
Look, there's some really, really good news in there. There's one little bad piece of news in there, but there's an easy solution to it. You don't eat uncooked ground beef. You buy cooked. McDonald's just cooks it for you. That's the whole point of ground beef. Just that's, I'm just throwing that out there. That's a little bit separate, but that's like really, really good news, right? And it's the type of thing that you don't normally see on CNN. We have to acknowledge that the economy right now is not the catastrophe that sometimes it feels like. And it is a mixed bag, I will say. There are some things that are not so positive. But the fact that CNN is acknowledging there are actually good things going on is a major, major situation. Now, this is kind of coming into the context of the tariffs. That's the conversation that a lot of people online took it to. Hey, you said tariffs are going to destroy our economy, and they haven't. Now, you've watched me do this for a long time. You know I'm not a big supporter of the tariff policy, but I've tried to keep it in perspective for you. You know, imported goods are about 10% of our economy. So even if you really screw with that, it's hard to screw up your entire economy solely with tariffs. And if you're doing other good things that are offsetting what damages might be building up with tariffs, you can have really good results still. I mean, it's just one policy. And, you know, of course, the media has freaked out about that. And this is all coming in the context of we don't even know if that policy is going to continue. The Supreme Court is set to rule on the tariff situation. We've been expecting this ruling for a long time. I'm not, you know, if you're a big tariff supporter, I wouldn't be overly optimistic on this, though I wouldn't necessarily expect it to be to set to where I want it to be, which is going back to the Constitution and having Congress control tariffs. I think it's going to be somewhere in the middle. We'll see on that one. The House is now starting to push back against specific tariffs. And this goes from a perspective of you got a bunch of Democrats. You got a very minor gap between these two parties. The majority is like, what is it, one seat now? Is it one or two? I lose track. People, you know, there's a lot of old people. A lot of them keep like dying while in office. It's very hard to keep track of. There's special elections going on all the time. But I think it's one or two seats right now. So basically, just a couple of people who really don't like tariffs can vote. And these votes will be coming now. A lot of them will be coming. The Canadian one was the first one. House defeats Republican bid to block votes on Trump tariffs. This is opening up to basically the House can vote on this whenever they want to say, hey, we don't want this particular tariff to exist anymore. And again, constitutionally, the Congress is the one that has this power. Trump and other presidents have taken big glumps of it before and just been like, oh, gosh, well, we're going to do this. And to be fair, Congress has handed them a lot of power in this realm as well. Now, you think of someone like Thomas Massie, who obviously has been, you know, up and down with the president. I mean, you know, they've had some good times. They've had some bad times. But he's very, very consistent on his values, which are, generally speaking, sort of libertarian values. And the libertarian values are going to be very much against tariffs. You have a couple people, I think three Republicans, were able to come out and say, hey, we don't want these Canadian tariffs anymore. It's going to be very difficult to stop that with the current state of the House. Now, the pro-tariff people were kind of talking about, hey, like, look at the economy is doing fine with these tariffs. And there's something to be said about that. I think the main thing that has to be said is the sort of hysteria of all of this from the beginning was never really justified. It's not, again, like, I can have a problem with a policy and recognize it's not going to overturn the world. I don't know that anyone in the media can understand that. I think everything has to be turned up to 11 and you just have to constantly be freaking out about everything. I don't think that's the right way to look at it. Honestly, it stresses me out too much to live that way. But that's the way the media constantly wants to live. The part that they can't admit at CNN, and this is very difficult for them, is that when you have a president that can control, I mean, look, he basically controls the Republican Party. He controlled what went into the Big Beautiful Bill largely. When you have a president who has that much impact, he's controlling a lot of what's going on in the economy. And when, you know, I'm throwing numbers out here, but like when 90% of the things are really helpful, and maybe there's 10% that I don't agree with or you might not agree with, you're still going to have positive results out of that. And that's why you look at a presidency not just based on one policy when you're casting your vote, but looking at it as the whole. Hey, like he's going to do a really good job with energy. We've been praising him on that for a while. He's doing a really good job with deregulation. These things are massively helping the economy. And at the same time, you know, tariffs maybe not as much. I mean, one way we can see that is if you talk to anybody about tariffs, what they would tell you is the goal of tariffs is not just to tax the American people on imports. It is to eventually build a manufacturing base in this country. Well, if you're looking at tariffs as the cause for the good economic news, it's tough to see that. Almost all the jobs that we have taken in since Donald Trump came back into office have been concentrated into arenas like healthcare. And like healthcare is not the type of industry, it's certainly not a manufacturing job. What we've seen is a very long consecutive month run of a decrease in manufacturing jobs. We are losing manufacturing jobs right now. It's a complicated picture as to why that's happening. I think, you know, if you just look at it as only tariffs, it wouldn't necessarily make you think that would happen. But that's what we've seen so far. Now, some of the stuff is going to take longer, even if it does work. If everything that Donald Trump hopes to happen does happen, it's going to take multiple years. You got to build factories. You got a lot of stuff going on. You'd hope some of the construction jobs would be popping in by now. But so far, we haven't seen that. We will see if that turns around in the coming months. We are seeing some negative things as well from that are related to tariffs. Ford is disclosing an additional $900 million tariff hit. Trump administration dealt Ford Motor a $900 million blow to close out the 2025. Ford said that U.S. officials alerted the company in December that a tariff relief program announced in October will be retroactive going back to November, not all the way back to May, as the automaker anticipated. So again, they're getting hit with these really high tariff rates. Donald Trump said, hey, this is a problem. We've got to give some relief on these tariffs to these companies. And he created a program. That program, though, not going back quite as far as they thought, so they're going to have to pay another $900 million. The year-end hit doubled Ford's anticipated tariff tally, capped the period that saw the automaker post its biggest ever quarterly loss, $11.1 billion, mainly because of previously announced charges tied to the automaker's electric vehicle business. This is key. The earnings loss compares to $1.8 billion profit from a year ago. Ford spent about $2 billion on tariffs last year and predicts roughly the same outlay for 2026. The number would be lower if not for last year's fires at a supplier of aluminum for Ford's best-selling F-Series pickup trucks. That's one strategy, by the way. You'd never have to pay tariffs if you light all the cars you're making overseas on fire. So that is, I mean, something I think you should consider if you happen to be an automaker. Fires sidelined a critical Novelis factory in New York, forcing Ford to import heavily tariffed aluminum until the plant is fully back online. Ford lobbied hard for the tariff relief program, which allows manufacturers to apply for credits to help offset duties, taxes on imported parts in vehicles used in manufacturers in the U.S. So a lot, this has been one of the complications of the tariff thing, which is like you're building your cars in the United States, but some of the parts are imported. Well, you got to pay tariffs on those parts. So that's increasing even the cost of you trying to do the right thing and make stuff here in the United States. Americans, not other countries, are paying for Trump's tariffs in 2025. New study out. American consumers paid nearly 90% of the cost of Donald Trump's tariffs. This is according to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. It is consistent with other reports. Trump's tariffs equated to an increase of $1,000 per household in 2025, up to $1,300 in 2026. Tariffs are the largest U.S. tax increase since 1993, according to Tax Foundation analysis. But this is what is being talked about here. And look, I do believe that tariffs are a problem for these companies and for the American consumers. That being said, is it the problem? We have a $900 million situation that Ford is dealing with. That's a big deal. But when you really look deeper at their numbers, you realize it's not just related to tariffs. Ford announced in December that it expected to take a $19.5 billion, not $900 million like the tariffs, a $19.5 billion in charges and losses to retrench amid sinking electric vehicle demand. Together, Ford, General Motors, and Jeep maker Stellantis now have announced more than $50 billion, not $900 million, $50 billion in charges as they pull back on their EV ambitions. Wall Street Journal has a big report out. Detroit automakers take that $50 billion hit as EV bubble bursts. Look at the charts here. Chartapalooza on the program. EV tax credit expiring on, which was, of course, part of the big, beautiful bill, goes into effect late 2025. And you see monthly sales have dropped off by well over 50%, which is remarkable. Now, that's kind of coming off a bit of a false high because people were trying to get their purchases in right before the deadline. But, I mean, even when you look at normal numbers, it's down 30 or 40%. Net profit, you see, Everything going fine for these companies, General Motors, Ford, and Stellantis, until this EV credit goes away. Things drop through the floor. Again, when you're building your business based on some government credit, if the only way it can succeed is if the government is giving you money, then you haven't built a business. What you've built is a rent-seeking operation. What you've built is an opportunity to bilk other taxpayers to pay for your crappy business. That's what we've built here with the EV bubble. And again, I'm a guy who owns a Tesla, or I lease it technically, but it is a car that I, generally speaking, enjoy. You know, some things are a little not so great about the purchase. The leasing process was kind of a disaster, honestly. But I will say, now that I have it, it's an enjoyable car. It's pretty effective, a pragmatic way from day to day. It goes really fast when I want it to. It's kind of a good experience, honestly. Like, I don't have anything against Teslas per se. I will say, if you're renting like in an apartment complex, I would not want that. I would want to make sure I had the way to charge it at home overnight. That makes a huge difference and takes away a lot of the issues that you have with these electric cars. So, but all this is to say is, like, I'm not against electric cars at all. I think some of them are really incredible. And, you know, Tesla's done a great job with it. Other companies, you know, there's a Porsche that's really nice, although they might be getting rid of that. I've heard, you know, some of these other competitors are good as well. But you see the sales dropping. And they are dropping by more in the United States. That is true. That being said, they're also dropping in Europe and in China. It's at least the trend line is down in Europe, although it's still rising a little bit. But even in China, which gets all the praise about how wonderful their EVs are, they are now dropping. So what about the future outlook? Remember, if you have built a company basically that is completely dependent on the government giving you free money every time you sell something, you haven't really built a business at all. So what is the outlook for that government cash? How's that looking? Well, one way was government cash just being handed out to these companies. Another way the left decided to do this over the past 15 years, and we've been talking about the endangerment finding. We're going to get into that more here in just a second. But the way they've been doing that is pressure on the other side, right? What they do is pass laws saying you have to have certain levels of fuel efficiency, for example. Well, how do you do that? Really difficult to do that with gas. So what the car companies were doing was investing highly into electric vehicles so they could raise that number of their fleet higher and cover and, you know, somehow comply with this government regulation. If the regulation is there, they're more incentivized to build these cars. Well, and I think this is a real positive, with the endangerment finding going away, which is basically the ruling, if you missed this from last week, we did a whole show on it, but basically it's the ruling to say that global war, you know, CO2 is something that you can regulate because it's dangerous for human beings. It goes back to a 2007 court case, and in 2009, the Obama administration went for it. Well, that one's going away. With the latest rollback, the U.S. essentially has no clean car rules. The United States will essentially have no laws on the books that enforce how efficient America's passenger cars and trucks should be. That's the practical result of the Trump's administration's year-long parade of regulatory rollbacks, capped on Thursday by its killing of the endangerment finding, the scientific determination that required the EPA to regulate greenhouse gases because of the threat to human health. Now, I read this story. I won't bore you with the entire thing because it is very, very boring. I just admit you. But I want to at least highlight this one thing. The headline again is, with latest rollback, the U.S. essentially has no clean car rules. I read you the last paragraph, I think, of the story. They have no rules on this. And I'll give you more of that. The United States will essentially have no laws on the books that enforce this. The U.S., quote, this is a quote from an EPA top vehicle emissions regulator. The U.S. no longer has emission standards of any meaning. Nothing. Zero. Later on in the story, like paragraph like 10, the EPA still regulates tailpipe emissions of specific pollutants. If the EPA decision holds, it could increase the country's greenhouse gas emissions by 10% over the next 30 years. Again, is that how? We don't even know if that's true. There's a bunch of different factors that go into that. But even if that were true, a 10% increase over 30 years. Again, you have to live in a panic. You have to be the most panicked person in the world to be that worried about that. But let me go a little bit later to like paragraph, let's say 25. The remaining rules. Now, remember, the headline is there's no rules, there's no laws. the remaining rules, such as fuel efficiency requirements, could be weakened. You just told me there were no rules. Then you told me, well, the EPA can still do a lot of, they still can have a lot of rules, and the remaining rules could be weakened. And then later on paragraph like 40, while the EPA continues to regulate pollutants, and on and on and on and on and on. By the way, to give you a picture of the state of the electric vehicles, the New York Times has a little, a healthy, helpful little like summary of all the things that are making the EV market so healthy right now. Ford Motor Company, reported that $50 billion loss. Tesla profits slump. Carmaker reported a steep decline in annual profit as cut car prices to fend off growing competition from established automakers like Volkswagen and new arrivals from China. I want to get into that in a second. Stellantis, the company, began unwinding its EV push last year, shifting North American product back to larger gas-powered models. It has revealed a loss of around $26 billion to cover the cost of reversing course and other restructuring measures. In Europe and China, the European Commission and China's Ministry of Commerce announced guidance that could lead to removal of tariffs on some electric vehicles imported from China, most notably Volkswagen's Cupra Tavascan, whatever the heck that is. I'm sure it's a beautiful car. I will say, some of those electric vehicles are pretty impressive from China. Technology is really, really good. Reviews are coming out really, really positive of these electric vehicles. Now, you can come up with problems with them, I'm sure. And those problems might be, you know, might want to prevent you from buying them. But I will say, we're looking at a situation now where China and Canada is going to have these cars and we're not. Canada says they'll buy cheaper Chinese EVs as tariffs drop. More than half of Canadians, or 53%, say that knowing an EV was made in China would have no effect on their purchasing decision. According to a new poll, further 15% said Chinese manufacturing would make them more likely to buy the vehicle, while 28% said it would make them less likely to do so. This is a reverse of a multi-decade trend here. Forever, that market has been viewed as a negative market, and we've been looked at as the positive one. Again, we've been in a big fight with China over tariffs and everything else, with Canada, also China, but Canada. And so Canada is now looking around and saying, okay, we don't like the United States as much anymore. Where can we go? They're looking to places like China. That's not good. It's a big change from 2024. 61% of Canadians said they would be less likely to buy a Chinese electric vehicle. Just 25% said it would have no effect on their decision. At that time, only 9% said it would be more likely. And the thing that concerns me about all this is I wonder if for the first time in my life that we're sort of putting ourselves in an M. Night Shyamalan The Village situation, where we're choosing to kind of put ourselves into a field and ignore the fact that a certain technology even exists, right? What we're saying is not, hey, we have better cars than China. What we're saying is China has cars that we don't want to compete with, and therefore, we're going to tariff them out of existence in our country, while everyone else around the world is trying them out and seeing if they like them. And we're kind of sitting here like, you know, people don't even know these cars exist. Unless you're like a YouTube car review nerd like I am, you don't even know these things exist. And again, they might not, be great. You know, I come back to this. At no point in my life have I been afraid of competing with China. What's happening in our country if we're afraid of competing with China on electric vehicles? If what our competition is that we're going to say, screw you, electric vehicles, and we're going to build the biggest, fattest, gas-guzzling SUVs possible and say, you know what, I think people like these more, that's competition. And if people want to come over here and they want to buy the Chinese things, let them buy them. The other thing is, let Elon cook here. Are we really worried that Elon Musk can't compete with China? I mean, I think if you free up Elon Musk to do what he wants to do and innovate the way he wants to innovate, my guess is he's going to beat the crap out of China and their stupid electric vehicles. I'm concerned that for the first time in my life as an American, we're now taking technologies and saying we're fencing them off. And we're saying you guys can't see those. You guys can't experience those because we're afraid you might choose them. That's protectionism, honestly. And I worry if that's what we feel the future of our country is. If we can't compete with China, eventually this stuff's going to get here. We can't hide it from people forever. Eventually a plane flies over the forest where your village is set up and people start realizing, wait a minute, there is this technology out there. I don't, you know, I understand the concern here, but I am, there's another concern we need to acknowledge, which is real, which is if we are getting to a place where we're afraid that we can't compete with other countries like China, we're in a much darker position than I think we all realize, or at least are aware of. So that's a concern, and it's something we should keep our eye on. Okay, we should also keep our eye on what's going on with the government cracking down on global warming and all these regulations and what they're doing to lift them. As I've said a million times, Trump has done an incredible job with this, and this is a really important change. Greg Wrightstone is going to highlight it next. An interesting part about the conversation about electric vehicles is not just that the market, generally speaking, hasn't been all that interested in them. It's the future of electric vehicles and all of the fights about climate change. The big thing that we focused on, I think it was last week, was the overturning of the endangerment finding. This is a massive, massive development that is not getting the play that I think it deserves. I want to bring in Greg Wrightstone. He is a geologist, an expert reviewer of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and also the author of A Very Convenient Warming, How Modest Warming and More CO2 Are Benefiting Humanity. Greg, thanks so much for coming back on the program. Great to see you.
Yeah, good to be on. What a great move by the Department of Environmental Protection Agency, Lee Zeldin, Donald Trump last Thursday, to the rescission of the endangerment finding. And it's big news, something we've been fighting for here at the CO2 Coalition since our inception more than 10 years ago.
Put this in perspective, Greg, because I don't think people understand. There's a lot of stuff going on, and I understand that people get distracted by it. But put this in perspective.
Your viewers' freedoms to choose have been restricted because of the endangerment finding. In 2009, the EPA determined, a few years before the Supreme Court in Massachusetts versus EPA, that CO2 is a pollutant that could be regulated. In 2009, the EPA did regulate it. This particular one was on light cars and cars and light trucks. And so they used this determination of a pollutant and dangerous warming from carbon dioxide to regulate, you name it, everything. If your viewers are sitting in their living room, look around. Everything that uses electric, the ceiling fan above your head, your dishwasher, washer and dryer, your vehicles, all of this really goes back to this endangerment finding. And so it's a great move to free up our options to choose. Right now, you're only allowed to buy a dishwasher, for example, that the government says you're allowed to buy. They say it's got to be it's an efficient dishwasher, but it takes 2.5 to 4 hours to do that. And so the repeal of this strips away all of the reasons to restrict things like that. And it's just huge, huge, huge. And the next day, they issued the actual rescission itself, 436 pages. I started going through and about lost my mind, but it's really good. I have to say, I'm a little, it's hard to be disappointed when it's being repealed, but we at the CO2 Coalition are scientists, and we filed two extensive comments providing the science on why this should be repealed. In their ruling on Thursday and the publication on Friday, they used two legal avenues. One was that the EPA didn't have the authority to do this, and second, that the temperature effect of getting rid of CO2 from automobiles was what they called de minimis. In other words, it's so close to zero that it's hard to distinguish. And in this ruling also, just think, in this ruling, using the IPCC's own calculations, getting rid of CO2 from cars and light trucks would have, I hope you are sitting, get down, that's good. Lack or the prevention of warming by the year 2050 was 0.007 degrees.
Wow.
7/1000ths of a degree by 2050, and 0.017 or 2/100ths of a degree by the year 2100. Well, that's, again, they call it de minimis. I call it, it's so close to zero. It's very, it won't have anything to do anything measurable to do with temperatures of the Earth. It's and that's a pretty good reason that they use just by itself. That small amount of warming from cars and light trucks should be enough to say, my goodness, you know, get rid of it by just because of that. But again, we published one comment that was titled Climate Change and Health, in which we went through and documented the various claims that have been made about the harms to the health of people, and show that it's just false. In fact, people are doing better because of modest warming and more CO2. And it's a, and I call it the greatest untold story of the 21st century, that of a thriving planet and a thriving of the human condition.
Can you, Greg, do a, I know you wrote a book on this. Can you give us an elevator pitch here for the book and for the argument that actually CO2 is not the devil that we've been told that it is? It actually is benefiting humanity, at least up until a point. If we have massive warming, maybe, you know, that would be something different. But what we've seen here and what we expect to see in the future actually isn't the end of the world.
Yeah. In my first book, Inconvenient Facts, I documented that there is no climate crisis, and there isn't. This next book, we took it a step farther, and that's where we are at the CO2 Coalition, in that by almost every metric we look at, Earth's ecosystems are thriving and prospering, and humanity is benefiting from the combination of modest warming and more CO2. It just is. It's so, and I had so much fun writing this book. You know, if we were at the Christmas season, I'd say, I bring you glad tidings of great joy. The Earth is not in crisis. The Earth is not, we're not going to, again, we're thriving and prospering. And one of my favorite subjects is the strong relationship between human history and climate history. And human history tells us that the past warming of periods, going back to the first great civilizations, were always hugely beneficial. There was no climate crisis and the periods were much warmer than today. In fact, you know, humanity and the human condition thrived and prospered. Food was bountiful. And it was the cold periods that were horrific. And so they would call me, they being Al Gore, John Kerry, Greta Thunberg, they would call me a science denier, but I would call them history deniers. They're denying what history tells us. History tells us it's just opposite of what they're saying. We should welcome a little bit of warming, 1.2 degrees in the last 150 years. That's led to an extension of the growing season by 2 weeks in the United States. That's a really, really, really good thing. And that's why we see, part of what we see is agricultural productivity just breaking records year after year from the coldest countries to the warmest countries. And that's turbocharged with increases in carbon dioxide. You, everyone that's gone through middle school knows that, what do you need for photosynthesis? Sunlight, water, and CO2, and the more CO2, the better. And that's what we're seeing. It's really, really a wonderful, true feel-good story about what's actually happening. We need to get this information out there. We're seeing, Stu, we're seeing a lot more people getting the climate realists is what we call ourselves, getting our message out there. We just had our chairman, Will Happer, emeritus professor of physics from Princeton, just sat down with Joe Rogan a few weeks ago. I think there'd been something like 20 million views. And they had a chance for over 2 hours to talk about the truth, about what's actually happening. And we're seeing Chris Wright at the Department of Energy, a great, great spokesman for climate realism. And he's rolling things back. He knows, of anybody in the administration, he knows the most about climate change and what's really going on. He's got both of my books. And we make sure that as we prepare papers, and we have created papers specifically for the Trump administration. And we don't have communication with them, but we make sure that those get delivered to their offices, Lee Zeldin in particular, Russ Voigt over at the OMB, and Chris Wright at DOE. And again, we're not having, our role here is to provide the information so those people, Doug Burgum at Interior too, Sean Duffy at Transportation, all of these people need to know this information. So we have hand-delivered those to their offices. And that's our role here, is to provide the science that disputes these claims of a climate crisis.
Let me do one more with you here, Greg, because this is, I think even some conservatives that hear you say, hey, actually, it's beneficial. They might be more on the side of, OK, well, we shouldn't have these restrictions or we shouldn't overdo it or whatever. But they might hear CO2 being beneficial as something that seems almost too far. And I think the reason for that is because we've had 45 years of the media telling us this is the worst thing that could ever happen to us. I want you to get your comments on this video. This goes back to 1982, 1983. Dan Rather talking about the climate crisis. You may have seen this going around on social media. Let me show this to you because it is an amazing clip and I'd love to get your reaction.
For years, scientists have theorized about the dangers of the so-called greenhouse effect, the warming of the Earth's atmosphere due to the burning of coal and oil. And in recent months, as David Culhane reports, research has uncovered facts to support that theory.
Uh-oh.
Many scientists claim that the temperature of the Earth's atmosphere has been rising over the past 100 years, that the great sheets of pack ice in Antarctica are melting at a much more rapid rate than previously. And finally, that the sea level has been rising with increasing swiftness over the past 40 years. If these scientists are correct, about 25% of Florida would be flooded, along with low-lying areas all over the world.
Amazing.
Climate changes could produce widespread disruption of agriculture. The American Farm Belt might be too dry, and the wheat and corn crops would have to move to Canada. Scientists blame the odorless, colorless carbon dioxide gas for these potentially dangerous changes around the planet. It is the greenhouse effect. The gas allows sunlight to filter down and warm the earth. But like the glass of a greenhouse, the carbon dioxide tends to trap heat so that it cannot rise into space. The scientists maintain that the coal, oil, and gas we've been burning for 100 years have produced more and more carbon dioxide and helped overheat the Earth.
It's amazing, Greg, because it goes on to even show Al Gore talking about this in that clip. But the only difference I see from that clip from the early 1980s and something that could air today is they've taken some of the uncertainty out. They now say all that stuff is definite rather than potential and using words like that. It's amazing to see, you know, what has happened to the media over almost half a century now.
Yeah, they're just not. It's really disinformation and it's intentional and it disappoints me and angers me at times that we see actual scientists out there spreading lies. They're not telling the truth, and I think they know it. You have to ask why. But in that clip that you just showed, how much time would we take for us to debunk just about everything they said was just factually incorrect? And just one key point here is CO2 is at 430 parts per million today. That's a 50% increase since the Industrial Revolution, granted. But the average throughout Earth's history was 2,600. That's 6.5 times what it is today. And at times we saw CO2 levels on Earth were over 4,000 parts per million, and we didn't have runaway warming. We had times when it was 4,000, 5,000 parts per million, and we were in a global cold period. So it's factually incorrect. The facts are we're actually in a CO2 poverty. We don't have too much CO2. We don't have enough, at least for plant life. Plants, they're not at their optimum growth potential yet. They might be when we get, if we can double, triple, and quadruple the CO2 in the atmosphere, we may get close to optimal growth levels for plants. And that's huge. We should be welcoming this. And just one example is one of the few things that I've seen recently. One of these alarmist claims was that poison ivy was going to escalate. There'd be more poison ivy because of CO2. And you know what, Stu, they're right, because CO2 is an equal opportunity fertilizer. All the plants will survive, will thrive and prosper, and even poison ivy. So I was laughing about that until I kind of thought more about it. But just about all these predictions they have, right, you had in this clip, again, they're history deniers, denying what history tells us about the benefits of warming and more CO2.
Yeah, it's like if you were to say, oh gosh, there's many more people going to the gym these days, you will also have an increase of people falling off treadmills, but that doesn't mean it's a bad thing. Greg Wrightstone, he's expert reviewer for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, author of A Very Convenient Warming, How More Modest Warming and More CO2 Are Benefiting Humanity. Greg, appreciate your perspective. Thanks so much for coming back on.
Thank you so much, Stu.
Look, it was a minor problem. Have you ever made a mistake in your life? I have. Everyone has. It's just a minor mistake. Now, there was a contest at a cryptocurrency exchange where they were giving out 620,000 Korean won. This is about $425. It's little bonuses as a part of their cryptocurrency exchange. And then there was a bit of an input error. You ever type something wrong, like maybe send a text to the wrong person? What's the big deal? So instead of 620,000 Korean won, they sent 620,000 bitcoins for the contest that was valued at more than $40 billion. Now that is oops, you know? So instead of winning 2,000 won, which was enough to buy a cheap cup of coffee, you at least momentarily received more than $120 million. Now, that's a lot and a positive thing. I will say that most of the people, I guess, either they reversed the transactions or were able to get most of it back. There's still outstanding about $9 million. People were like, oh, my gosh, and just transferred it off their account. Interestingly, this happened to me once a long time ago. I just got Bitcoin sent to me. It was several thousand dollars in Bitcoin. And I was doing a business with a company and they were like, I think this was a mistake. Please send it back to us. Now, I, of course, went on a great vacation. No, I actually did send it back to them. But I was thinking to myself, like, first of all, what a great guy I am. Secondly, I have in the years to come, it's been a long time. That was probably, it probably has been up 10x since then. I mean, that was a lot of money. So just remember, I'm a great, great guy. But anyway, it looks like they're getting most of their money back. By the way, I love this as well. It's President's Day, sort of. National Review ran this last year, and I remember liking this take quite a bit. There is no such national holiday as President's Day. And, I like the take in that, look, it's George Washington's birthday. We're just taking it away from George Washington. Like, what if we combine a bunch of presidents, all presidents, even the crappy ones, get a President's Day? They shouldn't. It should be George Washington's birthday. If you want to celebrate presidents, they've had enough celebration of them. Okay? Most of them sucked. All right, so let's just go back to George Washington's birthday and call it a day. Okay, so here's what happened. There's an island that was part of what once was Yugoslavia, and there it's an uninhabited except for a bunch of turtles, okay, tortoises. And so the tortoises are there, and the issue with the island is it's sort of like the audience of certain podcasts. It's 19-to-1 male to female ratio. Okay, now you could say this might be a problem for the ladies. Okay, they're in demand. Let's put it that way, and it's become a bit of an issue for them, to the extent, I kid you not, this headline is real. Constant sexual aggression drives female tortoises to walk off cliffs. This is a horrible story. These poor female tortoises are just, I mean, it's all they do all day. And at some point they're just like, screw it. I'd rather just plunge to my death. That's a real thing happening in this world. Anyway, another real thing that's happening in this world is you should subscribe to Blaze TV, blazetv.com/stew, and predictableshow.com. Get the Senate report, still available, predictableshow.com.